Saturday, July 6th, began at 5:15, and I learned what sunup looks like. For a midsummer morning, the sky was still dark, with just the first light coming up in the east. It was a beautiful phenomenon, but one I don't have the hardihood to repeat often. By 6, I was ready for Mrs. Berg, who obligingly came over at that farmer's wife hour, gave me a comb out, and with Lyndon and the staff, Jim and Larry, and Marie, Yolanda, and Mary Rather, left by chopper for Randolph Air Force Base. Lucy was already on Air Force One, a near miracle because she likes to sleep until 11. But from this moment on, throughout the trip, she was the most delightful traveling companion. Always on time, in a good humor, making our host beam, and telling her daddy over and over how thrilled, how grateful she was to be along. For years, she has recited the trips that Linda Bird has been on and ended up by saying, "You want to hear how many trips I've been on?" I tottered at once to the bedroom and tried unavailingly to sleep. And right on time, about 9:15, Air Force One sat down at San Salvador, El Salvador, at a beautiful airport, to a warm, enthusiastic crowd. Banners, bands, red carpet, welcoming flowers, musicians in native costumes, the whole familiar pomp and pageantry of an airport welcoming ceremony. President Sanchez of El Salvador was short, friendly, enthusiastic, stayed right by Lyndon's side the whole time, and indeed they were a pair, one so short and one so tall. Mrs. Sanchez spoke only Spanish, and that at staccato tempo. Our only ambassador, Raul Castro, looked more Latin than anybody there, spoke excellent Spanish, and he and his wife were both take-charge people, very competent, I thought. We were escorted inside. There was a receiving line. The diplomatic corps filed by. It seems to me I have never been to a country where there wasn't a representative of China. Taiwan, that is. It's a fairly large corps for such a small country. And, of course, a contingent of government officials. And then Lyndon went with President Sanchez, and I went with Mrs. Sanchez and Mrs. Castro, and we drove in a long motorcade with the other presidential couples, the Trejos of Costa Rica, whom we knew from their recent visit to Washington, the Somozas of Nicaragua, the Sevilla Sacasa proudly introducing his brother-in-law, the Lopez Arellanos of Guatemala. I had gathered in advance that he was the least cooperative of the group, and the of Honduras. Along the route, the crowds were thick, smiling, cheering, shouting, and there were banners stretched across the street, welcoming each of the five presidents. Mrs. Castro kept eyeing the size of the crowd, that feeling I know so well, and expressing her satisfaction on it. Yes, it was bigger than they'd had when Diaz Ordaz had come. It was the biggest crowd, in fact, she'd ever seen there. There was even a sign or two welcoming Lucy. I waved industriously out the window the whole time, although I don't think anybody ever knew who I was, for the car was not marked. Most of the signs said Bienvenidos, with maybe the name of the visiting president or the group that was welcoming him. There was only one shadow along the way. As we passed a building that appeared to be a hospital, there were people standing on the steps with a banner whose words I could not read except one, Viet Cong. I knew that was bad. Nobody did or said anything that I saw. Consequently, it was hard to recognize the hour's ride that I had participated in when I read the Washington paper next day, which headlined, "Paint Tossed on Johnson's Car," and a four-column picture of the Viet Cong sign, and in small letters below, "But most cheer his arrival in El Salvador." This is the age of the dissenter. So often I'm reminded of what Lyndon told the press one day, "Your business is to start a fight. My business is to stop one." We arrived at the Intercontinental Hotel a little past 10, and here we were supposed to just rest briefly and then get in a bus with all the first ladies and leave on a trip into the country with Mrs. Sanchez as our hostess. It didn't prove that easy. Five Latin American first ladies are hard to coordinate. Indeed, Mrs. Sanchez was right by my side and understandably nervous as any hostess would be at the delay, which went on and on, while I kept on trying to reassure her that it didn't matter. We'd get started sooner or later. There was much talk about whether to get on the bus and go on without them, and they could join us for lunch later or not. Mrs. Lopez Arellano of Guatemala came in and made her apologies. She would not be going with us. She did not feel very well. And finally, after an elevator that stalled and a few more misadventures, we did make our way to the bus, Mrs. Sanchez and Mrs. Castro and I, with a fuming Liz already there, and another lengthy delay while there were supposedly efforts to get in touch with Mrs. Somoza, Mrs. Trejos, and the wife of the president of Honduras. And I passed my time responding to the warmth of the people outside, who kept on smiling and waving flags and pressing their hands up toward the window, which I opened and shook hands with as many as I could and did innumerable autographs, only to find myself far outdone by Lucy at every turn, whose warmth enchanted the crowd. And about 11:30, still minus some of the first ladies, we started out. The trip had been arranged by Liz, who had herself advanced this one, and she had earnestly searched for the things that I enjoy most, and we did them. We were driving some 40 or so miles out into the country to the weekend home of President and Mrs. Sanchez. I think it is actually a sort of summer White House. The country was beautiful, the most verdant green. Steep mountains, lush little valleys. I saw my first real coffee plantations. Dark, lustrous green bushes or small trees about 10 or 15 feet high, and at regular intervals, another tree, slim-trunked, that then spread out in an umbrella shape, precisely for the purpose of shading it. Coffee must grow in shade, I was told, and these balsam trees have been found to be the best shade. They were not native. They'd been imported. It was a beautiful sight, very dense and very green, apparently carefully tended, each coffee tree loaded with berries. And it was appalling to think that each one of those berries, when it was ripe, was picked by hand. Mrs. Castro told me the harvest season began in early October and went on for 2 or 3 months. The school let out at that time, and everybody worked. And that is one of the plagues of the country. It is very much a one-crop economy. And when the harvest season is over, there is the specter of unemployment. It is a lush country, and everything grows. Pineapples, bananas, all sorts of palms, wild rubber trees, and hillsides on which corn is planted. And it's so steep, you wonder why the man working it doesn't fall down and break his neck. That is another problem of the country. Erosion washes all the topsoil away. The government tries to discourage planting these hillsides. The people must eat. Their diet is principally beans and rice. Our way, we were traveling the Pan-American Highway, led through little villages, pitiful, dirty, mud adobe houses, plastered over cane, Mrs. Castro told me, with tile roofs. Some of them were just thatched. The streets were full of hungry-looking dogs and nearly naked little children. Liz had said the best state gift we could bring them would be the loop. Mm-hmm. Along the village street, sellers of fruits, vegetables, chickens had their little stalls ranged. And at one point, I saw a woman emerging from a shop with a live chicken tied, carrying it by its feet. Sack of groceries, but mostly our way led through the countryside. There were fruits galore, papaya, coconuts, bananas, fields of sugarcane, and mango trees. I long ago decided that the mango was the most widely distributed fruit over the Lord's earth. There were old familiar flowers, such as hibiscus and bougainvillea and queen's wreath. And Mrs. Castro told me that the country was alive with blooming poinsettias, red and white, at Christmas time, and it was a joy to see. They grow wild. We were winding up all the time, from close to sea level at the capital city, to some several thousand feet at the lake, which was our destination. It was beautiful scenery, so lush and green, and I found the plant life very interesting, the mahogany trees and ebony. And anything would grow, even the fence posts. You could see a fence line that had sprouted so that it had looked as much like a hedge as a fence. And so, though it interested me, it appalled me by the enormity of its problems. So little land that could be cultivated, the rich green valleys, the land held usually in large plantations called fincas by what are called the 14 families, now somewhat more than that, and much intermarried. Next to coffee, the crops are sugarcane and pineapple and some cattle ranches. We passed by one, a field full of brown Swiss cattle, totally unfamiliar to me. There were ox carts along the road,
loaded with
wood or vegetables, and every person you saw was carrying something. All the women carried it on their heads in a basket. And there was the ubiquitous bus that I had come to know so well in Mexico. The lifeline of the country, it seems. It makes a regular schedule, stopping at brief intervals, and it has a big rack on top. And all the farmers that can afford to pile onto it, put their goods in the rack on top, and head for the marketplace. I asked Mrs. Castro what the wage was, and she said 50 cents per day, and that you paid $24 a month for a maid, and at $40 a month, her butler was probably the best paid servant in the city. And so there was little to cheer you about the people, though the country itself was beautiful. Perhaps one cheering sight was the numerous schools. She told me that the Alianza Para Progresa had built 2,500 school rooms in this little country. One of the most discouraging signs I saw in the small villages through which we passed, which all had plazas, of course, with trees and benches and old folks resting and young folks courting, was that some of the plazas had been turned into parking lots, the interior gutted of their trees and benches, an entrance street put in, the interior filled with rather sad-looking vintage cars. What a blow for the charm, what little there was, of these little villages. Before we left the valley, we made a stop that Liz had planned for my special benefit. Off the highway a bit, we had seen what appeared to be hummocks covered with grass. We bounced across a field. We stopped, got out and walked. And as we got close to them, we saw that there had been excavation work on at least two of them. There we met the archaeologist, who spoke excellent English and was, I think, an American attached to a university in El Salvador, and who had about 25 years ago done the archaeological exploration here. They had gone only so far. They had no money to continue. What they had found revealed a people that had lived here long before Columbus, that had some kinship to the Aztecs and to the Mayans, had probably, he said, been about 50,000 people inhabiting this valley, close to the same number that are living in it now. There were carvings of parrots, serpents, linking them to the pyramids in Mexico. What had wiped them out, we could not say, whether an invading tribe or an epidemic. But there was a basket of artifacts that had been picked up on the spot, and the collector had brought them for us to look at. Little things that might have been household gods, or toys for children, and some vessels for eating or storage, either very sophisticated or beautiful, but all with the aura of age and mystery that lit your imagination. We went on from the past to the future, an agricultural experimental school, which we toured with the director. They have all sorts of citrus fruits, apples, lemons, grapefruits, all sorts of vegetables. And we stopped in a shady spot for a little welcoming ceremony with all the boys who are studying there, and to have refreshments of coconut milk, which I drank hopefully and bravely. These boys, I am told, were studying to become what we in this country call agricultural agents, going out into the counties to teach the farmers how to raise better stock and crops and vegetables. I can't think of a thing that could mean more to this country. They were silently watching us. So I walked right up to them and tried to talk, daring to speak a little Spanish, getting the interpreter to tell them how important I thought their work was, and hoping that they were learning it well and learning to teach it well. And I felt good about this part of the trip. And then we rode on, ascending more steeply, and coming in view finally of a beautiful crater lake, clear, lovely water, rimmed all around by the steep, green-clad mountains. Mrs. Castro told me that the bottom has never been found, but there's a curious legend of some evil force or strength. Perhaps it's an undertow or a swirl out in the middle. But many people have drowned. But occasionally, when a plane has been lost in the lake, it could never be found. It is the crater of a volcano, and how deep into the bowels of the earth it goes, no one knows. And though it was beautiful, it was also rather sad to me, because I did not see people swimming or boating or fishing on it. We drew up at the gate of the Sanchez home, and I asked if I might walk, thereby precipitating a minor crisis, because it appeared if I walked, everybody felt obliged to walk. The last thing I wanted, that I had been riding for so long, and I wanted to see the country at closer range. And I'd understood it was not even a quarter of a mile to the house. So out we got, some of the ladies in high spike heels. But it was my favorite quarter hour of the day. For one thing, I passed one of the women I'd seen so many along the road, who was carrying a big straw basket on her head, full of slices of pineapple, little cakes, things to sell for the people who ride the buses. There are no hot shops along the way. The numerous flies didn't seem to bother anybody. I stopped and talked to her and asked her if she would show me how she balanced it so nicely. She took it off. There was folded up on her head a sort of a pad, perhaps it was a jacket or an apron, and on it the large and rather heavy basket was balanced, and she walked gracefully, probably for miles and miles, but nobody seems to walk if they can help it. And I'm sure my hostesses considered me bizarre and eccentric. The way led nearly straight up after a while, between towering jungle-like trees, mango and rubber, I think some of them were, but here in this higher land, a familiar pine tree had appeared. And then there was the house, and the family of our hostess, Mrs. Sanchez, her mother, several of our children. We gathered out on the terrace. We were offered scotch or a soft drink. We looked at the view. And then the first ladies took our seats together, and all of the other guests settled on the shaded terrace above Lake Cotopaxi. And we were served a lunch of turkey and ham and a sort of curried rice dish. And then when the dessert course came, there was dish after dish of sweets that came by. And each one, I thought, was the only one. A tray of tarts. And then some bright-colored miniature strawberries and pears, all sort of little things made of almond paste. And glazed and sugared fruits and nuts. Finally, and of course, the product of the country, El Salvador coffee, quite delicious. I had been given a necklace, each of the guests had, made of coffee beans. I had promptly put mine on, and one of the ladies had brought up a branch from a coffee tree loaded with the little berries, green now, turning to brown and purple later, I was told. And the work looked infinitely harder of picking them one by one, especially when they ripened at different times and you had to go back and pick and choose again and again. I sat close to Mrs. Somoza, whose English was as good as mine, very sophisticated, very pretty, wearing a large diamond ring. She had traveled a great deal, she said, in Europe, in the States, apparently had lived only a part of the time in Nicaragua, but now that her husband was president, she would be there the whole time, she said. I asked Mrs. Sanchez to describe her life on the finca, and it turned out, to my respect and admiration, that she really participated in the running of the plantation. She knew how to, and had vaccinated many cattle, and had given artificial inseminations. We had pictures with all the Sanchez family down by the swimming pool, and then with Mrs. Sanchez and Mrs. Somoza and Mrs. Trejos and Mrs. Castro. We left the lake house, Lucy coming along in another car, and returned to the capital, driving by the volcanic lava beds. It was a very interesting sight. The whole island is covered with volcanoes. The last one had erupted in 1919, I believe. Off in the distance, you could see a mountain peak, and then a great black river which wound its way down the mountainside, came right up to the highway which cut through it, and continued on the other side. Mrs. Castro said if you got out and tried to walk across it in tennis shoes, they would be in ribbons within a block or two, so sharp was the lava. Only in a few places had an occasional tree found a pocket of soil and grown. Mostly it was a great black silent river turned to stone, like a weird surface of the moon. I was glad for once that we decided to leave the bus and return by car, and by 5 o'clock we were at the residence of the U.S. ambassador. The Castros had moved out to make it available for us, and it was a lovely, open, elegant house. She told me it had cost about $350,000, that everything there was terribly high. And so, after our very long and busy day, I fell into bed for a rest and reading some of the package of books that Mrs. Castro had given me. At the gate of the embassy, there had been a crowd of people, all smiling, cheering, and each time we entered or left, there they were. Once they sang "The Eyes of Texas." Always they waved American flags and held up babies to have their hands shaken or kissed. And particularly, they called out to Lucy, who was in turn at every moment, in love with the crowd, in love with the whole trip. This was no around the world in 17 days. We actually got a 3-hour rest. And then, into cocktail clothes, back to the Intercontinental Hotel for a reception hosted by President and Mrs. Sanchez for all the presidents. Angie had told us we need stay only 30 minutes. I had felt that was rather short shrift to express our appreciation, but after the rather offhand manner in which the other president's wives had either been very late or not come at all to Mrs. Sanchez's tour and lunch, and after this reception, which was first scheduled for 7, and then it was postponed till 8, and then we were advised not to come until we heard that our hosts and the other guests were there, and then got the word to come at 9, I decided this was another set of rules, and I might as well relax. We stood in line quite a long time, meeting once more the diplomatic corps, the officials, quite a few hundred people, mostly, I am sure, El Salvadorans, and were back at the ambassador's residence about 10. Lyndon and I and Lucy and Larry Temple, Marie and Mary and Yolanda, who had not gone to the reception, joined us. We settled in the beautiful living room while a storm blew up. Thunder and lightning and rain. This is the rainy season, they tell me. We had a dinner prepared by the stewards whom we had brought with us. And then, for the next 2 hours, comfortably grouped in the living room, we shared one of those times to remember. When Lyndon reminisced and philosophized and thought out loud, and I sat enchanted listening, as I believe the others did. We talked of the whole political and social spectrum of the day. About communism, what was its vitality today and in our country? What was the virus or miasma that was infecting the universities and the communications media and the entertainment world? He said, there are two conflicting emotions in me about communism. And then something like this, there's a great tide running, a great pendulum swinging in the country. And in response to the permissiveness, the liberalism, the lawlessness of the day, there may be a great swing to authoritarianism, back toward conservatism, and there'd be a part of me that'd welcome it. They would think it was necessary. But then there's the other side of me that says if that happens, we'll set back all the things I stand for, that I've fought for, that I want, the attacks on ignorance and poverty and disease, that will set them back decades. He talked as though he were a long way off, looking at this small planet, and I found it very interesting. I asked him if he didn't feel his enthusiasm blunted, his quest for more education for everybody in this country and for other countries, when he saw students behaving, and professors too, in the way they were today. Draft burning, flag burning. For myself, I find it so easy to be passionate rather than thoughtful about it. No, he was just as firm in his faith in education, ultimately. I did not understand his feeling quite. It was something like this was just an episode, a phenomenon, it would pass. And as for the professors, partly he thought because for so long, in this country at least, their salaries, their economic status had been low. They were feeling power for the first time, were enjoying a kind of revolt. I was respectful of his attitude, even in a way proud of it, but my own annoyance is not assuaged. And then we talked of days of long ago, of Mr. Clayburgh. He hoped that his papers, or copies, could go into the library someday. And the friends that he and Mary and I have shared for many decades. Finally, about midnight, we went to bed.